Hi, I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge.
Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. Today is the day you have made. I will rejoice and be glad in it. And I won't worry about tomorrow. I'm trusting in what you say. Today is the day. Today is the day.
Good morning. Welcome to Mornings with Carmen. I am Carmen LaBurge. Thank you for taking me along on your journey today. Let me ask you this question. When I say good morning, what makes it good? What makes it good? God makes it good. God, whose mercies are new every morning. Indeed, great is his faithfulness. That's not only a truth, the truth from God's word, from the psalmist. That is the lived truth of your life every single day. That is the lived truth of your life right now, that God's mercies are new this morning, and great is his faithfulness. God's mercies are new today. God is good, and you can trust him to be so. So the knowledge of the character of God, the knowledge that there is a God and that he is good, friends, that changes everything. When you woke up this morning, it was by the grace of God. As you move through this day, it will be by the grace and the goodness of God. Whatever you do in word or in deed, do it all to the glory of God. What gets you up in the morning? You might be tempted to believe it's the alarm clock or the rising tension of the demands of the day or even the coffee. But ultimately, what gets you up in the morning is, in actuality, not a what, but a who. You are not alone. You are not alone in the day that is set before you. Whatever challenges you may face, you will not face those challenges alone. God is with you, and God is good. Good morning. God cannot be anything other than good or great or faithful. And so with that confident joy, let us turn our attention to the issues of the day. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Good mornings. I am Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. Joining me now, Dan Moran from the Institute for Religion and Democracy. Dan, welcome to Mornings with Carmen.
Hey, good morning, Carmen. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So you recently wrote an article on the United Methodist Church. And so I would like to begin assuming we know nothing about the structure, the discipline, or what's happening in the United Methodist Church. So can I start with this question? Describe the United Methodist Church and its structure.
So the United Methodist Church is a global denomination of Protestant Christians that reaches not only across the United States, but across Africa, much of Europe, even parts of Southeast Asia, like the Philippines. The church is founded on the theology of John Wesley, who was an English minister. And so what's going on? And it's still the largest denomination in the U.S. today, largest single United denomination. And what's going on today is the church is having a debate, or maybe better, a fight, over the issues of human sexuality, particularly whether to ordain pastors or other people who are openly in same-sex relationships, as well as whether their churches will perform same-sex marriages either in their buildings or by their pastors.
So let's pause there. Let's pause there, and let's back up for just a second, because I think that those who are in the conversation with us right now, you know, like some of them come from a Roman Catholic background, some come from a Lutheran background, some come from a Presbyterian background, some, you know, are Southern Baptists. And so when we think about the structure of the United Methodist Church, and you tell us that it's global, and yet these conversations that are being had are, at least from what I can tell, pretty much confined to the United Methodist Church here in the United States. So what's the relationship between the United Methodist Church as a denomination here in the United States and United Methodism globally? Like, help us understand a little bit of how that works.
Right. So the churches are very connected. They share the same church practices, though they change context to context in different cultures or even in an urban or rural setting. But they follow the same theology, at least in theory. They all gather together to make decisions in a governing body known as General Conference. And so clergy people and lay people come as delegates from every region of the church, and they come together to vote on what the church will do, what the church stands for. And so normally it's every 4 years, but this weekend they're going to gather in a special general conference to vote on these issues of sexuality.
Okay, so the event that's happening this weekend is actually a global meeting. Is that correct?
That's right. That's correct.
And the issues specifically that this meeting has been convened to address are these issues of sexuality and church leadership. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, now outline for us what the proposals are before the body.
So there are four proposals, but two in particular are the most important and truly have a chance of passing. There's one called the One Church Plan, which we at IRD and UM Action, which is the Methodist program at IRD, we believe it's a bit of a misnomer. But the One Church Plan would liberalize the church's stances and the church's teaching on sexuality. It would allow for clergy to be ordained if they are in same-sex relationships. It would allow churches to decide whether they wanted to conduct same-sex weddings in their church or whether a pastor individually wants to conduct those weddings. It would not, in word, compel churches to do this, but the de facto position would be that churches are allowed to do any of these things if they want to. The second plan is called the Traditional Plan. It's the one that the IRD supports and endorses. The Traditional Plan would uphold the UMC's discipline, which is like their book of church law and social principles. It would uphold the discipline and reaffirm that marriage is between a man and a woman only. And it would add real accountability measures to these standards, these teachings of the church, because right now they're being broken left and right in the American church, the American UMC. And an aim of the traditional plan is to actually allow for real unity in church practice and teaching.
Okay, so there's no question that the United Methodist Church Book of Discipline upholds what you are describing and what the proposed plan under the term traditional. Mm-hmm. There's no question that that's what the current, that's what the historic current always has been a position of the United Methodist Church globally. That has been the position all along. And so when we talk about the traditional proposal, what we're talking about is a proposal that is consistent with the theology and espoused rules in terms of church leadership and governance of the United Methodist Church, really for all of its history.
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
And then the other plan is a clear departure from that in every way.
Right.
Okay, so I just want, the reason that I ask it that in that most basic form, Dan, is because, you know, folks who are listening at least have friends who are United Methodists, attend United Methodist churches. Some of our listeners are United Methodists, and they're actually hearing this for the first time. They're saying to themselves, I did not know there was the potential schism coming in my denomination. I didn't know this. I have not, I've not been made aware of this. I didn't know that this weekend was literally like it's either going to be a house united or a house divided, depending on what is decided And you and I both know, Dan, that depending on what is decided and then how people react or respond to that is going to determine whether or not the U.S. version of the United Methodist Church actually remains intimately connected to global United Methodism. So can we return to that subject in just a moment?
Sure.
So thank you for taking us with you on your journey this morning, wherever you are going. If you are listening to us live on the Faith Radio Network, you are under a winter storm warning and advisory. I'm coming to you from a place where there are flood warnings, and Dan is in a place where everything is wonderful because it's Washington, D.C. Okay, so we're going to be back in just a moment. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge.
Be strong in the Lord and never give up hope. You're going to do great things. I already know.
Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, continuing my discussion with Dan Moran of the Institute for Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C. The article that we are discussing is posted at the IRD's website where they blog, which is called juicyecumenism.com. And you can check it out there. The United Methodist Church is on the verge of the same kind of decision-making process, hopefully maybe not the same decision, that has been made by other mainline denominations in the United States of America in terms of issues of authority, sexuality, and I would say ultimately marriage, because you can't have the ordination conversation. You can't allow people who are in same-sex relationships to be ordained and then tell them they can't be married. And so marriage will come hot on the heels of any discussion about LGBTQ ordination. So, Dan, the United Methodists, they're not the first Christians in the United States, not the first U.S. denomination to find themselves battling over these issues. They would be following on the heels of the UCC, the Episcopal Church, the ELCA Lutherans, the PCUSA Presbyterians. Every single one of those denominations has already plowed this ground and ended up splitting. So what did you learn in researching how those other denominations moved through this process?
Yeah, the thing I found was that there's a really remarkable pattern here. Was in the past 10 or 15 years of these Protestant denominations having these debates and discussions over sexuality and, like you said, marriage, doing studies and eventually deciding to open up the options to allow churches and pastors to have different standards. And what we found time and again in every single one is that, of course, there was an expected exodus of more conservative churches, of traditional Orthodox Christians. But what we also found in every single one was continued decline, continued fractured relationships in these denominations. And not a single one has ever rebounded and started to grow or started to attract greater numbers of young people, which of course is something that has been promised in every single one.
So full disclosure to those who are listening today, I was really heavily engaged in this conversation when it took place in the Presbyterian Church USA. And I would say that, the side for which I was advocating did not ultimately prevail in terms of the PCUSA's decision making. And so the PCUSA is now a fully affirming LGBTQ plus denomination, and I am no longer a part of it. And so, Dan, when you look at what the UMC might learn, the lessons that they might take away from the failure of each and every one of its sister mainline denominations, what are some of the lessons the UMC might take away and might take into this weekend in terms of handling its present crisis?
I think one very important lesson to remember is that, especially as a truly global denomination, the UMC should learn from PCUSA, ELCA, and others, that a global missional outreach, a global connection with other brothers and sisters in Christ across the world really requires upholding marriage, upholding traditional values in the church, because our fellow believers in Africa and Asia, the vast majority they don't want these new ideas and policies on human sexuality that are being pushed for in America. We saw with Presbyterians in particular, a number of different other Presbyterian bodies across the world broke their relationships with them, either immediately or a few years after they made this decision to be LGBTQ affirming. So if the United Methodist Church were to go down the same path, they lose this incredibly valuable and deep connection with their African churches and some of their European and Asian churches.
And then I think we should be, you know, quick to remind everybody that ultimately the bride of Christ is a unified whole. So from God's perspective, you know, the bride of Christ is not, she's not broken. She's not diminished. The question, Dan, that I always sort of settle in on in these conversations is why here, you don't have to answer this. This is more a rhetorical question than anything else. But why is it that we tend to think or imagine that what we're doing in institutional Christianity here, in terms of continuing to break it down further and further, is in any way reflective of the unity that Christ prays for in John 17. And I, you know, I'm not living with a hope for institutional unity across all of the various denominational lines that now exist in Christianity upon the earth. But I do recognize that this is about the witness of the church to the world and what the church has been called into being to do and why she exists. And we're here to glorify God, not ourselves. We're here to help other people see who God is by introducing them to Jesus, not to be sure that, you know, we are free to live however we want to live and do whatever we want to do. And I'm holding out great hope that the United Methodist will have the courage and conviction to do what no other mainline denomination to this point has proven herself able to do, which is to actually say no, uphold the authority of the scripture, uphold her own discipline, live into her calling in terms of the purity of the bride of Christ on these issues. And so when you think about what's going to happen this weekend and you think about your hope for what's going to take place, you know, I just encourage I know you'll be praying, but I would encourage you to encourage our listeners in any way that you want to now. Is there a way that folks just out across the country not only could be praying, but is there anything that they can do to help?
Yeah, absolutely. They can pray. If they want to help, I would say in particular, if you are a United Methodist, if you go to United Methodist Church, you're a member there, talk to your pastor, maybe find out what their perspectives on these issues are, because their leadership is going to matter a lot in the coming weeks and months, regardless of what plan the General Conference adopts, because every local church really is going to be impacted. And so the more you know, the more conversations you have with your pastor, the easier any transition time will be for your local church. And that's going to be so valuable to ensure that, you know, your work and your mission of your church isn't interrupted. Another thing I would encourage listeners with is to remember Jesus talking in Matthew just about being the salt of the earth. You know, people everywhere crave a church that is authentic, that is real, that is different from the world. And that's what, you know, this salt is. And Jesus says, if the salt loses its saltiness, you know, how can it become salty again? And it really can't. That's the answer. And so I would encourage readers to just hold strong and to be that change, that difference in their community, in their church, something that's totally different from the culture around them. Because ultimately, that is what's going to help bring people to the gospel, to Christ.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Mornings with Carmen. We appreciate what you are researching and what you are writing. Folks can find Dan at theird.org. That is the Institute for Religion and Democracy in Washington, D.C., and they post at theird.org. You are listening to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBerge. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. You and I worship a God of all grace, to whom is due all glory. You ever find it difficult to connect the eternal with the everyday when it comes to the political headlines? Well, then you're going to appreciate what's next. Hunter Baker from Union University joins us to bring light to bear on the border battle, how the 2020 presidential field is staking out positions, and whether or not there's really room in the race for a third party candidate. I'm Carmen LaBerge. Thanks for taking me along on this portion of your day as we walk by faith. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. When was the last time you attended a wedding? So I saw on, I don't know, it was probably Facebook, but it could have been Twitter. I don't know, some social media feed yesterday. So this young woman invited her grandmother to be the flower girl. So she was a, instead of being, you know, a flower girl, she was the flower granny. And she, you know, very dutifully walked out there when she was supposed to, ahead of the bride, and she's casting the flower petals about. And as she's walking, she's making this declaration that this is the first wedding she'd ever been in other than her own. And that was actually new information. Like, nobody knew that. So celebrations of milestones matter. I want you to consider the joy of new relationships and marriage. And I want you to consider then the celebrations that we have on the anniversaries of our marriages. I've got an 8th anniversary of my own coming up in May. Very much looking forward to that. But here at Faith Radio, we're actually celebrating 70 years of God's grace poured out over the airwaves. And today, Faith Radio is a nationwide network. You may be listening live in any one of our Faith Radio markets. You might be listening in the Twin Cities or in Duluth, Superior, Hartford, Madison, Waterloo, Bismarck, Fargo, Moorhead, Kansas City, or Sioux Falls, or you may be listening, streaming live at myfaithradio.com. You might be listening on a connected device via the Faith Radio app. You might be listening to the podcast. So the reach of Faith Radio continues to grow, but it all started with the vision of a praying people who wanted to see the good news simply reach their neighbors in the Twin Cities. And we're celebrating that this year in a 70th anniversary celebration. If you want to celebrate with us, consider coming to the campus of the University of Northwestern in St. Paul to the Night Performance Hall on the evening of March the 16th, 7 p.m. Check it all out at myfaithradio.com. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen.
To say all religions are the same and should be treated equally, I say all religions are not the same. This is Jim Garlow. Every religion has a corresponding system of ethics that produces its own culture. The heightened cultural tensions we have in America are a tug of war between competing religious ideologies of humanism and our Judeo-Christian heritage. Freedom of religion and its corollary, the freedom of speech, are paramount to a free people and for government of, by, and for the people. Biblically speaking, we're tapping into a tradition dating all the way back to the Old Testament when Nathan exposed King David for his sin, to the New Testament when John the Baptist called out a Herod. No legitimate government can infringe on our private or corporate worship of the Lord, giver of our rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of virtue. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, joined again by Hunter Baker from Union University. Hunter serves as the Dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. He is a university fellow. He's the Associate Professor of Political Science. He's the author of 3 books, The End of Secularism, Political Thought, A Student's Guide, and The System Has a Soul. He writes frequently. He is a researcher for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. He's also, he's a prolific commentator, and so I enjoy talking with him about the headline news of the day. You can follow him on Twitter. Help me out, Hunter. What's your Twitter follow?
I'm just Hunter Baker.
There you go. Just Hunter Baker.
Yeah.
Love it.
Welcome. I'm older, you know, so I'm older, so I kind of have the handle, right? I'm the first Hunter Baker out there.
Are you a hunter or a baker or both?
Well, you know, people make fun of my name.
Do you bake what you hunt?
Because I don't really do either. But if you put, I went to law school and I'm a professor, so people say that I combine like four professions: doctor, hunter, baker, lawyer.
Nice. Doctor, hunter, baker,
yes.
Lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, we could probably spend a lot of time just talking about that. But let's do this. Let's talk about the border, the proposal, you know, I don't even know how to quite start. There's a lot of people in America that do not approve of President Trump's declaration of a national emergency at our southern border. So let's just jump into
yes.
that conversation. Bring people up to speed on, on sort of the sense of things across the country in terms of this conversation.
Okay. Well, just to be really quick, President Trump has obviously been seeking funds to build a border wall. There's no question that that was his number one initiative. That was the primary issue upon which he ran, both in the primaries and in the general election. And so he is determined to deliver on that promise, or at least show the American people that he is doing absolutely everything he can to deliver on it. Not having been able to, so let's be fair, the Republicans had the House and Senate when he was first elected. And, he really did not have the full support of the party in trying to get the wall. And so he was not really able to get there. And then after the Democrats took the House, it seemed even less likely. Through the shutdown, he's been able to get some money, but not as much as he wants. And so he has declared an emergency. The question is this constitutional? Yes, we have a National Emergencies Act. But if you look at the things that were done under the sort of the label of emergencies, we don't see something quite like this, right? This is what he's trying to do with the wall seems more like a classic get Congress to appropriate the money, spend the money, balance of power, separation of powers sort of thing, the way we're used to our government working. So there are significant questions as to whether what he's doing is constitutional.
So let me just fill folks in case they haven't read this yet. There was an NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll that finds that more than 6 in 10 Americans disapprove of President Trump's decision to declare a national emergency in order to build barriers along the U.S. border with Mexico. So the question that was posed to people was this: do you approve or disapprove of President Trump's declaring a national emergency to build a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border? Now, Hunter, you and I could debate all day whether or not the question was a good question. But I think that when we just look at the sheer numbers, if 6 in 10 Americans disapprove of this action, and we know we have a president who cares very much about polls, I'm wondering if you foresee or forecast maybe some flexibility here.
That would be great. I mean, the first thing I want to say is that it heartens me. Now, I'm not saying that I think a wall is good or bad in saying this, but it heartens me that Americans are worried about this use of a National Emergency Act. The idea of declaring an emergency to get done what you can't through the normal legislative process is very worrisome to me. You will eventually have a Democratic president. If you do something like this, a Democratic president may say, I'm declaring a climate change emergency. I'm declaring an emergency with regard to incarceration, or whatever, right? I mean, there are all kinds of possibilities. So there's that, right? But second, is he flexible? I don't think so. And the reason maybe he'll lose in court, and he may be okay with losing in court. But I think that he is determined to show voters that he is trying to fulfill his promise no matter what. So I think he will take it to the absolute limit.
So, Hunter, back in 2016, when the conversations all started about who would be the next president of the United States, I described the then candidate Trump as a person who I judge to be eminently morally flexible and ultimately a pragmatist. And so if you have somebody who is morally flexible and ultimately really concerned about pragmatism, I think that, you know, the predictability question is the difficult one for most of us. Maybe let's leave that conversation there and turn to a conversation about what is shaping up to be the 2020 election cycle. So President Trump is clearly going to be, it appears to me he intends to run again and seek a second term. Do you agree?
I do. Yes.
OK. And he's going to have some opposition in doing that. And so how about you and I grab a cup of coffee and take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about we're a year away from the start of the primary season, but there's lots of folks already jumping in. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen. I am talking with Hunter Baker about, all things politics. We'll be right back.
If I should speak, then let it be of the grace that is greater than all my sin.
Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, continuing my discussion with Hunter Baker from Union University, and we are shifting gears to talk about the 2020 presidential primaries. November 3rd, 2020 is when we are all going to vote on the next president of the United States. We are all fairly confident that the Republican candidate will be the current president, Donald Trump, although there's a lot of time between now and then, and who knows what may happen. But the campaign cycle on the Democratic side has already begun, and we've got a lot of folks who've already thrown their hat into the ring. So, Hunter, why don't you highlight a few candidates that you find interesting and talk about sort of the varieties of positions that folks are staking out?
I'm not sure I can remember all of them, but I'll bring
no, you won't. You won't be able to. It's a crazy long list. I mean, I would throw some names out if you want me to, but then I might be choosing a name that is less familiar to you and others. But we could start with Julian Castro, which would be interesting for a president of the United States to be a Castro.
That's true. Former mayor of San Antonio, if I recall. And housing secretary, I would put him in the realm of no shot.
We'll just move on.
Let me say, it's really not an adequate platform from which to run for president when you have just been the mayor of a city. Maybe if you're mayor of New York City, maybe. But generally speaking, it's not an adequate platform. And if you're talking about cabinet secretaries, the housing secretary is not the one that really gets your attention in that sense of having that sort of real executive experience. Look at who declared, I guess maybe it was yesterday, the day before, Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, let's do Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Great. Bernie Sanders. I view Bernie Sanders as the Democrat who would be most threatening to Donald Trump in some ways. Yes, he's old. Yes, he has been chosen to be known as a socialist. But there is a sense in which he appeals to many of those Trump voters. He has an appeal crafted directly at sort of the blue-collar, white working class, in addition to parts of other parts of the Democratic coalition. But for instance, Bernie Sanders' views on trade and immigration would be fairly similar to Donald Trump's in certain ways. So I think he would have a real shot. And of course, he did extremely well against Hillary Clinton. He might have even won the nomination had it not been basically set up to produce a victory for her with the superdelegates and things like that. You mentioned Elizabeth Warren. There was a time when I would have said she would be super formidable. I think that between Donald Trump and her own actions, I think that she has really handicapped herself. I think that, there's more and more evidence of her having claimed to have been a Native American. you know, many of us understand that to claim to be a Native American plus being female would significantly advance one's career, especially within academia. You're talking about a woman who graduated from Rutgers, which is a fine institution, but one would not often go from graduating law school at Rutgers to teaching at Harvard Law. So she seems to have been able to advance her career through these claims of being a Native American. I know she denies that, but increasingly we see that she did make those claims. So I think she has really harmed herself through that.
So when I think about the primaries and how they work, it occurs to me that either Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, one of the two of them, are likely to win the New Hampshire primary. They are, they are from neighboring states. And so when you think about anybody else really, really pouring their attention and money into New Hampshire and their time, maybe more particular their time, because New Hampshire seems to be a, you know, you got to go sit in everybody's living room kind of place. Really, everybody else is competing for third.
That may be. I mean, you're definitely right that there's an advantage in being close to New Hampshire, not only because people will be familiar with who you are, but also because that makes it easier to kind of camp out in the state. You know, people who live in New Hampshire, they are unlike the rest of us. They are super accustomed to having a ton of access to presidential candidates simply because they have that First in the Nation primary. So, there's an advantage. They'll be there. They'll be there all the time. But, you know, I wouldn't necessarily take that to mean that somebody else can't break out and win. But you're right. They have an advantage.
All right. Now we've got listeners in Iowa who are now, curious why I haven't talked about Iowa yet. And the Iowa caucuses and the change to the way that the caucuses are going to be handled in Iowa. And there's also changes in California in terms of how their primary process is going to work, when they're going to start. They're going to allow early voting that's actually as early as the Iowa caucuses. Talk with us about how the landscape is changing as the primary process is changing.
Well, in Iowa, of course, we have the caucuses rather than a typical primary.
They think the rest of us are atypical. They think the caucuses are typical and the rest of us have primaries, and that is atypical.
Well, at one time they would have been right. at one time, you know, political candidates did tend to be chosen through caucuses and things of that nature, but that has largely passed. It's really interesting. My understanding is that Iowa has a state law that it must be the first caucus in the United States, and they will move the date up no matter how far it takes to be the first. And New Hampshire likewise has a law that it will be the first primary in the United States, and they will move it up to go ahead of any other state. And South Carolina has kind of a similar position. They are the first in the South. In some ways, that South Carolina primary may have become more indicative of success than the other two. So there's this constant battle. That's really interesting what you said from California. I had not been aware of that, but that would be a big deal. Especially on the Democrat side.
Yeah, I mean, I think it privileges Kamala Harris pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. She's a creature of California politics for sure. And, you know, if that happens, there's no telling what the sort of the chain reaction will be in terms of other states attempting to advance their own candidates' interests.
So, Hunter, you and I are going to have a lot of time to circle back around to this subject matter. And as we do so, over the course of the coming months, one of the things that I'm hoping to be able to consider is what do we know about the faith of not only the faith espoused, but the faith lived by various candidates on the trail. So maybe we can take up those conversations in the weeks to come.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much, Hunter, for being with us again here on Mornings with Carmen. I'm going to grab another cup of coffee and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Mornings with Carmen. I'm Carmen LaBurge. Thank you for taking me along on your way this morning. Wherever you're headed, let us remember that this is the day the Lord has made, and we are going to rejoice and be glad in it. Whatever we face, we are going to face it with the confidence that we are, we're with the Lord in it, and He is with us in it. And so let me encourage you today to be abiding in Christ in ways that actually deepen your roots and produce better fruit in the lives that we're living out there in the world. So maybe do a little fruit inspection today. I checked the bananas at my house this morning, and they are right on the verge of being, like, perfect. And you know that that means that, like, 2 days from now, they're not going to be perfect anymore. So let's do a little fruit inspection in our own lives. Is my fruit production for Christ, my love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, and self-control, is it being produced in ever more abundant measure? If God were to evaluate the fruit of my life today, is He going to be like, Carmen, I need a little more attention there given to the patience portion? And so now you and I recognize that all of these are to be produced in ever more abundant measure so that God might actually get a harvest of righteousness. That's what we're going for here, a harvest of righteousness through my life, through our lives, rendered unto God, to whose glory we now live. I'm Carmen LaBurge. You're listening to Mornings with Carmen, and we'll be right back. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Mornings with Carmen LaBurge from Faith Radio. If you haven't, you can subscribe to automatically receive the podcast through iTunes or the Google Play Music app. That way, you never miss an episode. It's also available anytime at myfaithradio.com.